All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Taking the floor.
Mr. Sobieki.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Mr. Verrucchio's convictions must be reversed for two main reasons. First, the district court's interpretation of the gratuity statute cannot be reconciled with its plain language, Supreme Court's opinion in Sundiamond, or this court's opinion in Valdez. Second, Mr. Verrucchio was denied a fair trial. If the government, writ large, wants to, one, enact laws, and then, two, enforce those laws, then they have to provide a fair trial. Because Congress made the decision to use speech or debate clause to deny Mr. Verrucchio access to material evidence, then the only acceptable remedy is that Congress doesn't get to see its laws enforced.
What is the definition of material evidence, as far as you're concerned?
Your Honor, this court in United States v. Yunus, reading Valenzuela, Bernard, it's a flexible standard, but the phrasing this court used was a reasonable possibility of affecting the outcome, balanced against the strength of the government's case. So that is the standard I think we're looking at here.
Well, we imposed a prejudice standard in the Dean case, didn't we?
Your Honor, I admit I'm not familiar with the Dean case, but looking at the Supreme Court language, I think it's a balancing test, taking the evidence, and in this case, there was significant prejudice given the critical nature of the evidence to Mr. Verrucchio's defense. So I think even looking at a prejudice standard, like something that would be applied in a Brady situation.
Well, isn't that exactly what the Supreme Court said in Valenzuela Bernard, that Brady will be the definition of materiality for purposes of the compulsory process? That's page 868.
Your Honor, even under the, I think we meet the Brady.
So why do you say even under, if Supreme Court in defining materiality for the purposes that you want to use it specifically says, has that borne out in Brady versus Maryland?
I apologize for misspeaking, Your Honor.
Oh, you don't have to, no apology necessary. I just want to be sure we're on the same wavelength here then. So you have to show a reasonable likelihood that it's going to affect the outcome of the case, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so what evidence do you have that you think will affect the outcome of the case?
On the speech or debate issue, taking the testimony of Vivian Curry, the government's theory of the case was that the commission of the gratuities offense was complete no later than the end of the New York trip. Evidence introduced after that did not have independent significance. It was probative of what happened during the trip. What were the parties thinking? So they trotted out instances of Mr. Verrucchio having interactions with these lobbyists as evidence of what happened on the trip. Vivian Curry, as we proffered, would have come in and said, I was talking to Jim Herney about these issues. Mr. Verrucchio's name never came up. I talked to Mr. Verrucchio about these issues. They never came up. And what if she went as far as to say, yeah, you know what, he told me he wasn't going to help them out whatsoever. That's the material outcome.
When you say that wasn't part, do you have any proffer with respect to that?
Your Honor, we proffered that she would say yes, that to her knowledge, Mr. Verrucchio was not inserting himself into the process.
That's an after-the-fact point, right? That, you agree, is not required for the gratuity statute. And as you just said, it's complete after the trip. So the fact that her testimony is about what happened several months later, her testimony that he didn't insert himself into the process, at least with her, it's not exactly exculpatory, is it?
Oh, I think it is, Your Honor, because it's directly rebutting the government's evidence of the same nature. The reason the government brought up the letter-writing campaign, the suggestion, the review of the white paper, was because it was probative of what happened during the trip. Along the same lines, if we introduced evidence that he was affirmatively not doing anything after the trip, that undermines the outcome. And we still have a situation where the other individuals, all alleged co-conspirators, Ms. Curry was the only one who did not have, shall we say, skin in this game. And one of the key pieces of evidence the government had was an email from Herney to Curry that said, Frazier is good to go. We expressly proffered that Ms. Curry would have addressed that email, one of the government's key pieces of evidence.
Well, that was Herney's email to her.
Right.
So he was a witness, and your client had an opportunity to cross-examine him.
Yes, Your Honor, but we cannot cross-examine him about what her understanding was of the email and whether or not she discussed his email with Mr. Verrucio.
Other than the proffer that she could explain away the fact that he was not inserting himself into the legislative process, the rest of the proffers are very generalized, aren't they?
Your
In
Honor,
terms of what the district court had before it.
Yes, Your Honor, but that's sort of the nature of this issue, right? The defendant doesn't have access to the evidence that he wants to introduce.
Well, so, I'm just at, you know, the standard for you to show this is material evidence.
And in Valenzuela, the court said, if you come up with the categories, what are the facts, what are the events that the witness would testify about, that can be your way to showing materiality. And here she also would have discussed his role in the process. And I understand other witnesses also could have talked about this, but we're talking about evidence that this grand conspiracy actually only involved a very few number of people, one of whom was Vivian Curry. So that, I think, alone is that we're talking about one of the critical individuals that these co-conspirators thought they needed to lobby.
Did trial counsel interview her?
Yes, Your Honor.
So this is not a case where we have to give great latitude for the fact that you didn't have an opportunity to know what she would say. There was an interview. You did know what she would say. You proffered what she said she would say at the interview. We don't have to go any farther than that, do we?
No, Your Honor. I mean, one, the interview is limited. I mean, we don't know. She was obviously, I don't think there's any evidence in the record that she was, and, you know, eventually she did stop talking to defense counsel and invoked her privilege. So I think it was a guarded.
She did that in the middle of the interview?
No, not during the interview.
So you had a complete interview with her in which she told, this is way more than normally happens in these cases. You had an interview, so, and you've represented to us what was said in the interview. So we don't really have to speculate beyond that, do we?
Well, Your Honor, that interview was prior to the beginning of trial. And so we also have everything that occurred at trial that also she also could have been questioned about. And that is, you know, at the time we didn't know how the government was going to use their evidence. How were they going to use Government Exhibit 88? What was Herney going to say? Herney was not willing to talk to.
You did know about the good to go email.
Yes, Your Honor. But we did not know what Herney was going to say. None of the co-conspirators would meet with us. And she also would have talked about his role in the process. That I think it's important that if she would have said, you know, unlike the government's theory that Mr. Verrucio was the puppet master behind the scenes, she would have said, no, look, he really didn't have that much influence. And so the question, again, is not that fact in and of itself would have, we can say, is dispositive and would have turned the outcome of the case. But when we add all of this up, in addition to, we have to consider the weakness of the government's case.
Before we get to that, let me just ask you, your argument here is simply that because she wasn't permitted to testify, the case should be dismissed. You also have an argument about whether the speech and debate clause was properly viewed by the district court here?
Correct, Your Honor.
So, but you did not make that argument below, correct?
We made the argument that Mr. Verrucio's Fifth and Sixth Amendments right to present a defense and call witnesses, that right was never waived. That right was asserted.
No, the balancing argument that you make on appeal.
Correct, Your Honor. The balancing argument was not framed in those expressed terms. I think it was certainly implicit.
Could you tell me where? I have the transcript in front of me. I don't see anything implicit. I don't see anything at all. In fact, what I see is complete agreement with the congressional party's brief saying that's an absolute privilege. It says we really don't have many quibbles with House counsel's brief.
Your Honor, yes, I'm familiar with that. And I think at that time, how I read that is acknowledgement that those acts, yes, are legislative acts. And today here, we're not challenging the classification of those communications as legislative acts. A separate question then is, just because they do come within the purview of the speech or debate clause, does that mean they then trump Mr. Verrucio's fixed?
I understand the second question, but I don't see it in the transcript.
Your Honor, I point to, I will have a cite for you on rebuttal, but when counsel argued.
Well, the district court asked counsel specifically, do you have any other alternatives? And then counsel went on. But this balancing argument, I don't find that.
Your Honor, I think there's maybe two separate issues. Right after the district court ruled, there was a confrontation clause issue. They had introduced a number of statements.
Right. Before that.
Right. And this is separate, the affirmative evidence that we wanted to offer. And when counsel was making the motion to dismiss argument, I think it's abundantly clear there, it was a few days later, that government counsel kept trying to classify it as a confrontation clause point, and counsel expressly said, no, Your Honor, we have a Fifth and Sixth Amendment point here. We wanted to present this independent evidence. So that is where I would point to, Your Honor. At that time—
Was that after the case had already gone to the jury? Or
no, Your Honor, prior to that.
What's the precedent for balancing a speech or debate clause protection? It's always been assumed to be absolute, as I read the cases.
Correct, Your Honor, right? I mean, and it's, and frankly, this issue has never come up. As far as I know, there's never been an instance where a defendant's right to present a defense has have to have
been
balanced.
There's been no suggestion, Supreme Court case law or in the text of history of the speech or debate clause, that it could somehow be subject to a balancing.
Not balancing. I think Gravel certainly hints at that the sensitivities could require a different result. I think this court and Brown and Williamson also suggested that, hey, wait a minute, maybe we just shouldn't assume it will apply the exact same way in the criminal context as it does in the civil context. And then looking at other similar privileges that we talked about in our opening brief, there is precedent for balancing very important privileges against a defendant's right to present evidence.
But if we concluded this was plain error standard, that everything you said sounds like not plain error, right?
Well, Your Honor, I think that would just be limited to the quashing of the subpoena. I mean, we certainly preserved a right to dismiss the charges on.
I understand that, but you raised, as I started, two separate questions. Mm-hmm. One, did the district court make a mistake about, for example, your balancing argument? If you didn't raise the argument, and if, as you said to Judge Kavanaugh, there's no precedent for the argument, suggests you don't have plain error. You still have your dismissal argument. You still have the question of the confrontation clause, for which you then need the Brady materiality.
Well, I would say yes, Your Honor, first, but not confrontation. We're doing a right to compulsory process and right to present a fair defense as the rights that were violated by the district court's decision. And then looking at the remedy on those points, I think the only acceptable remedy will be dismissal of the charges. I understand.
Can I ask you about the gratuities charges?
Yeah, yes, Your Honor.
Which is, you list the five acts that are evidence in this case. And for acts 2 through 5, I think you rightly say that those may be problematic under Valdez because it's really money or gifts for information, but the first act is not of all these kind of situation. That was gift for actually influencing the contents of the legislation, for taking action in the legislative process. And given that that evidence is in the record, how can we overturn the conviction? Because that evidence clearly would qualify as an official act.
Well, just to begin, Your Honor, to separate the two points, I know in the government's brief sort of intimated we didn't have a right to challenge the indictment. So the evidence in the record I set aside for the moment and just focus on the language in the indictment influencing the highway bill. The problem there comes from Sun Diamond. Sun Diamond says that you need a specific act.
It is a specific act to influence the highway bill. That's not the specific bill in question was known. The specific acts that were getting a package of amendments into the highway bill. So that strikes me as a lot different from the Sun Diamond situation.
Your Honor, I agree the goals there are specific. Mm-hmm. But how was it going to happen? And that's the key question is that, I mean, let's assume the—
Well, wasn't there evidence about the airmail strategy? I mean, ultimately, when we get into the evidence of sticking in the amendment at the last minute to avoid the opposition that would arise from the nature of the suggested amendments?
There was evidence that advice was given regarding strategy. Mm-hmm. And then I think that's just act.
The expectation and known to the defendant, there is evidence that suggests the expectation was that the defendant would take some action to help make it happen on the House side, just as another person was going to do that on the Senate side, right?
Well, Your Honor, I disagree that that inference can be drawn from count two of the indictment.
How about the evidence in the case? Let's talk about the evidence in the record.
The evidence in the case, no. I mean, if I'm not, well, I know Mr. Bacon was confronted with that issue on cross. He was asked, you know, so the plan was Mr. Verrucio was going to swoop down and insert the amendments at conference committee, and Trevor Bacon said, no, I'm not saying that. So I don't think there was, again, was there any direct evidence that that was going to occur? No. Not that I recall at this point. Now, could that have been inferred? I don't, that's a different issue, Your Honor. But on the—
Would you agree that evidence that the giver expected the defendant to help in meetings with other staffers to insert particular language into the final highway bill, would you agree that that qualifies as an official act?
No, let me ask. So we're talking about the evidence at trial, mm-hmm. right? And from the evidence in this case, no, Your Honor. If that inference could be drawn, mm-hmm. yes. I don't think that inference can be drawn on the facts of this case. Mm-hmm. If I may finish answering the influencing question, mm-hmm. Your Honor, I think about it as, let's say the allegation was influencing the highway bill through making photocopies. Mm-hmm. Okay, he's helping them make photocopies. That's certainly influencing the bill. But unless we know how he was going to influence the bill, because in Valdez, I think it also implicates Valdez, using his official position. How was he going to use his official position to influence the bill? If influencing, I think the reasonable inference from influencing in the indictment is that he was going to dispense advice. Write your congressman. Mm-hmm. Try it at conference committee.
If all you had was dispensing advice back, then there would be a Valdez problem, I think. But it's not just dispensing advice back to the giver. It sounds like there was at least an expectation, and a reasonable one, given the position and activities and discussions and evidence in the record, that there was going to be specific help in getting the final bill language, final language into the bill.
Not in the indictment, Your Honor, and in part—
Talking about the evidence of the trial, I think that's the—
Oh, okay. Just want to note, in the indictment, paragraph 13, so this is a sort of situation, you know, classic interpretive principle where the government uses language in one place and not in the other, it should have significance. Mm-hmm. Paragraph 13 of the indictment says Bacon and Verrucio, you know, were going to personally act to insert the amendments, not distinguishing who was going—
Do you agree then, for the purposes of that count, you don't have an argument with respect to the indictment, is that right?
Correct. We're not challenging count one of the indictment. Of the indictment, yes, Your Honor. So the fact that they—
So this depends on an interpretive canon contrary to a justum generis and no soter, that is, that you consider all these things among the things that are around them. Your canon would be neither which I've ever heard used, employed with respect to an indictment, that when the language is different in one section, we should treat them completely differently rather than the canon that says language should be read in context with the other language.
Well, Your Honor, each count must be considered separately, so we can't draw from—
If it must be done separately, then we can't draw the inference you want to draw either.
Your Honor, I think that was just an additional point. Looking at the evidence, there's nothing in count two to support the inference. In fact, there are other instances. You look at after influencing, four specific acts, none of which suggest inserting amendments at conference committee. There's a—
None of which do what?
None of which suggests that Mr. Verrucio was going to personally act in the decision-making process. They were just dispensing advice. So I guess my question is, well, where else then in count two can we draw the inference that he was going to personally take some action? In other words, I think all of the evidence points to the opposite inference, that influencing was just a shorthand for dispensing information.
Further questions for the panel? Okay,
thank you.
Ms. Heller.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Kirby Heller for the United States. Let me start with the gratuity offense. And it is our position both that the indictment and the proof were sufficient. The crux of the indictment is that Verrucio accepted this trip knowing that the donors were giving it, that the lobbyist and United Rentals was giving this trip in hopes of inserting favorable amendments into the highway bill. It was a very specific question that that was before the government, that is, should these amendments be inserted into the highway bill? And when Veruzio accepted this trip, there certainly was sufficient evidence that he knew that was their purpose. The crime is committed when he accepts the trip, and the evidence sufficiently showed that. First of all, he was very involved in the highway bill. Before the trip even took place, he had had a discussion with Blacan about United Rentals, what they wanted done, what their amendments, the conceptual ideas behind the behind their amendments, and they talked about strategy. We're going to insert this at the last minute because we know there's going to be opposition. The acts that took place later, although not necessary for proving that he accepted an illegal gratuity, showed, in fact, that there were things that he could do to assist, to help influence what got into the highway bill. The indictment alleged, and the evidence showed, his job responsibilities were to do just that. He was the go-between, the committee, and interested parties and other staff people. So that the purpose, one of his job responsibilities, and these were specifically alleged in the indictment, was to bring the concerns of the committee to the lobbyists, from the lobbyists to the committee, and that's why this trip was offered to him.
To the extent, and I realize you're gonna say there's more evidence than this, and I understand that, but to the extent there was a charge simply of giving gifts in order to obtain information about the process, about the status of the bill, advice about how to proceed, that's all got a Valdez problem, doesn't it?
I don't believe there's a Valdez problem in this case, Your Honor. For these,
I understand you don't think in this case, but on that hypothetical, if it was just gifts for getting advice about the process and information about the process,
in general, if it was just that and it had nothing to do with assistance on a specific
correct
question, then that could be a problem. That's not what we have here, and that's what gets us out of Valdez.
Okay. You were going to say because all the other evidence about the specific acts to influence the legislation?
Well, the acts that he did do afterwards shows, in fact, that the lobbyists were correct in approaching him. This was, again, these were all in a to-wit clause in the indictment. These were all things that the Veruzio could do, and in fact did do, although we didn't have to prove that, to help influence the amendment, helped influence the highway bill and help the lobbyists get what they wanted into this very specific question that was pending. That's certainly all that's required under the gratuity statute, and that's what the government proved.
What's the difference? There's an instruction between about bribery and the distinction between bribery and a forward-looking gratuity. Can you succinctly explain the difference between bribery and a forward-looking gratuity?
The difference is that there doesn't have to be this quid pro quo. The fact that this is a forward-looking gratuity
still has to be for or because of, though.
It definitely has to be for or because, and that's what we had.
Yeah.
We had these lobbyists giving this trip for the help that Veruzio could offer in the future. And that's certainly made clear in Sun Diamond that is one of the possibilities.
The jury seemed confused because they asked a question right on this
right
point, right?
And then they got...
And I think understandably confused because I think this is, when you try to distinguish bribery from a forward-looking gratuity and jury instruction, you're asking for trouble. In terms of confusion, so I'm not sure they really grasped it.
Right, but then they asked that question and they got the very succinct answer that the parties agreed to, which is we don't have to prove, the court didn't actually say quid pro quo, we don't have to prove that the defendant actually did anything. What we have to prove is that he knew when they gave the gift that they were giving it for or because of something they wanted done. That's precisely what the statute requires.
So the distinction between lobbying, where you're trying to influence an influential staff member to be receptive to your client, just get not on board in the blackened sense, but you know, here are our problems in this industry. We want you to understand them. There's no mention of any specific amendments, but the discussion goes along the line of, you know, let's go to lunch, let's go to New York for dinner. Where is the line drawn?
Well, certainly we have on the one side the Sun Diamond issue. We're taking you to lunch, we're taking you to the World Series, so we have this reservoir of goodwill. And then we have the other side, of course, which is this case, something very specific. But I think
I just want to be clear. It's the fact that we have the lobbyists saying there are three specific amendments that we're interested in having made to the highway bill. That's the line.
Well,
in other words, if the lobbyist had said, hypothetically, suppose my client was interested in amendments 1, 2, and 3, what would you advise?
They were asking that of the staff person?
Yep.
And they had given the trip either after or before? I think that would be a gratuity.
I just want to understand where the line is, because Sun Diamond keeps talking about, you know, bringing the staffer along to be receptive to industry isn't what we're talking about here.
Right, and again, I believe that was, of course, there was nothing specific at all. Interestingly enough, in Sun Diamond, there are actually very specific things that industry was interested in. They just weren't charged, and it was never the theory of the government. We probably would be in a very different place if they had just charged that and proved it. But I think Judge Kavanaugh made the point, and I think it's an important one in Valdez, in the concurrence, that there's not much room here that really gifts shouldn't be accepted, and staff and congressmen would be foolish to think that they can wiggle out of it after the fact. Obviously, the reason, and in fact, Mr. Boulanger explained to this, he had two different approaches. There was his sledgehammer approach, which is, again, this really building reservoir of goodwill, like we'll approach everybody when we think something might come up that might help us down the road. And then we have our scalpel approach, which is when we have something specific, we're going to target who we ask, and there's a reason for that.
Just on Judge Rogers' question to follow up, because she asked you if it was just gifts for answering questions about how best to proceed strategically or what kinds of amendments. You would have a Valdez problem with that, wouldn't you?
Well, again, is it assistance? Assistance, giving information is assistance, and that
that's what Valdez says doesn't work. It's very specific about that. So information alone, I think, is going to be a problem for you.
I
just want to make sure that's clear, but obviously, you'll say there's more than just giving information alone in this case.
Well, I will say that, but I also think that labeling something giving information doesn't really tell the whole story. Is why are you giving information and to what end? Providing assistance is, of course, one does it by giving information. I think about the Biagi case. There, the congressman took a gift. He also took a trip to help a certain company, and he met with various people and also with this company. If he was giving assistance to the company by saying, Senator D'Amato or the Secretary of Navy said the way to get your contract with the city is to do X, that's giving information, but it's certainly also giving assistance.
Well, I don't know.
I don't think that's what Biagi rested on.
Didn't rest on that, but that was certainly some of the things that Biagi did.
It sounds like that's the backstory to how they know what the client needs. But in Biagi, as in Ring, as I thought you were arguing in this case, they went back and forth to find out what the client needed, and then the idea was this would be information the defendant would use to get into the bill what the client wants. Is that right?
That's right, Your Honor.
By the defendant taking the action. That's the key.
Right.
To help get it in the bill. I mean, that's the key that gets...
That's correct. The
You got a Valdez problem otherwise, I think, because Valdez does say we do not believe that a release of information can constitute a decision or action on any question, et cetera, et cetera. But so if it were just giving you information, here's advice on how to navigate the congressional process, and that's it. I'm not going to do anything for you, but here's advice about how to, which members to hit, which things to do, how to structure your amendments. I don't think that works under Valdez. If it is, I'm going to give you information, and I will then go to the meeting and help plant your amendment in the bill. Then you've got a, then you're out of the Valdez problem, I think.
Well, I think that's true, but I don't agree that the first would be a Valdez problem. I think there are worlds apart between this case and the kind of information that the defendant was giving as his assistant to them to get their amendments into the bill, as opposed to what does this whale search show? Mm-hmm. And again, I think the crux of Valdez was that there wasn't a question that the government could answer. That's not the case here. It's not, I mean, yes, the court talked about giving information, but it was giving information divorced from anything else. Here we don't have that. And certainly the assistant that these lobbyists wanted from Verruzio, and what he said, what he admitted was, which is they want me to help them get their legislative agenda passed, would encompass all the things he did as part of his job responsibilities in doing that. And part of that was going to them and saying, here's the best way to do it. It's going to influence Congressman Young if you get letters from a variety of people. I think, yes, that's information, but it's assistance.
Because of the three amendments. That's why I want to be very clear. Is that why you think this is such a strong case?
Yes. Yes.
And we don't have to deal with the more difficult case.
We don't in this case, Your Honor. I mean, we don't.
Yeah. I suppose the government would be better not to test us in some other case, if that's the way you're putting it.
Well, I'm not saying that it wouldn't apply with facts less strong than this. I'm just saying in this case, the court can certainly decide it on that.
Well, if it's purely information disclosure, obviously bribery is a potential charge, too. In fact, in a lot of these cases, you could charge bribery and gratuities and go. I think that's what happened in Valdez.
Well, that was the Valdez problem, really, is that it was charged as bribery.
Is the government's practice now not to charge both in the same case?
I'm not sure about how that's influenced charging practices, Your Honor.
Okay.
Just to turn briefly to the speech or debate clause issue, and especially the dismissal of the indictment, the evidence that the defendants wanted to get in was in no way material. First of all, the critical emails were redacted, were stricken from the record, and the Herney email that was mentioned, in fact, was offered by stipulation.
But all that happened mid-trial. Hadn't the email been read to the jury before redaction?
They had been read, and defense counsel at trial made a strategic decision not to have any kind of limiting instruction. They didn't want to call attention to it. Certainly there was...
No. But my point is the evidence wasn't stricken from the jury's consideration in the sense that the jury had already read the unredacted email.
They had read that, and...
And so you say Mrs. Curry was totally not material. Is that what you said?
Well, I said her testimony wouldn't have been material.
Right. Even with the jury having read that email to her?
Well, again, there could have been an instruction that said, you heard some testimony, you're not to consider it. The parties have decided, I've ruled that you're not to consider it.
But so you're saying that the defendant, in a strategic effort to avoid calling attention to potentially disastrous evidence, somehow waives or somehow lacks any force to his argument that Mrs. Curry's testimony would have been material?
Well, I believe that the testimony wasn't necessary to counter these emails because the emails were no longer, the parties agreed the emails couldn't be relied on in argument. I'm not sure whether the evidence went to the jury.
And that's like the elephant in the room. You know, the jury has read the email. And the agreement was simply that the prosecutor agreed not to argue about it in closing argument.
Well, I do think that the strategic decision that defense counsel made answers that question. If they
were,
is that right that the only thing that strategic decision does is mean that defense counsel has to take it as if there had been a limiting instruction? And then we're in the situation of, if there had been a limiting instruction, yes, there's an elephant in the room, but we got a lot of elephants in the rooms in our cases. Apparently, in the next case, we have whales in the room, but in this case, we have elephants. And often we say that a limiting instruction is sufficient. I don't know whether it would be in this case or not, but you're at least entitled to argue here, given the decision not to allow a limiting instruction, that had there been one, that would be sufficient.
What I'm trying to understand is a limiting instruction would have been, ladies and gentlemen, ignore what you read in the email that said the defendant is ready to go. Now, that just calls the jury's attention to it even more.
And that's why defense counsel made that decision. But as Judge Garland said,
I don't understand why that necessarily means that Mrs. Curry's testimony is not material. The evidence is before the jury, limiting instruction or not.
Well, if there was a limiting instruction, Your Honor, I believe that wouldn't be before the jury. It's no longer there for them to consider, and that's the ultimate question. Can they rely on this evidence, and therefore do they need something to counter it?
Sometimes limiting instructions work, and sometimes they don't. And we've often held that that is not sufficient to mitigate the prejudice. All right, so I just want to understand that the defendant, and this was all argued to the district court, anticipating that Mrs. Curry would be a witness, had not interposed various objections to the emails. Then learns mid-trial Mrs. Curry is unavailable, acknowledges that her testimony is covered by the speech or debate clause. Under those circumstances, I just need to be clear how you're defining material.
Well, material is, would it have had an effect on the verdict? Now, a couple of points on that. First of all, since the government didn't have to prove that the defendant was inserting himself into the process, evidence that would say he didn't wouldn't have affected the verdict. Second, there was a lot of evidence that the defendant then focused on in summation that there was lobbying of other staffers as well, including Ms. Curry. One email that got in fact, said was a response to Herney from Ms. Curry that said something like, you know, thanks for lunch, or I, you know, thanks for the tickets to the football game, I can't go. There was evidence from Herney that he was lobbying her. There was a lot of evidence that the defendants brought out that, in fact, there were the lobbyists were talking to other staffers, and there was an exchange of emails, and Verruzio wasn't even on any of them. There would be these meetings about the language in the amendments, and he wasn't even on these emails. So they got to make their point and press their theory that he wasn't involved in this process, a fact that the government didn't have to prove in the first place.
So under our decision in Dean, are you familiar with that? It has to almost be outcome determinative, as I read that opinion. It even goes a little beyond Brady.
I don't recall the exact, I am familiar with the Dean case, I don't recall the exact language of it. I believe there was a harmless error argument that was the relevant point.
You agree that the speech or debate clause is absolute in these circumstances?
I do. There are no other, like, see, I've gone over my time. Thank you.
Hi. Does the appellant have any time?
The appellant did not have any time remaining.
All right, we'll give you an extra 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
One thing I'd asked is if you had any place in the record where the balancing argument was.
I'm going to start. Well, balancing argument, the proffer, Fifth to Sixth Amendment rights.
I can infer the
365 in our appendix, original appendix, to 370 is where the argument was made. Judge Rogers.
365?
Yes, Your Honor, 360.
See, that is the place I thought. That's after the parties had rested.
Correct.
And so it's too late at that point to make an argument other than the dismissal argument that you want to make.
I think that indicates, Your Honor, what I was saying is that was the parties had there was a Fifth to Sixth Amendment right was raised. There was no waiver of that.
No. I don't think that's really contested, that this is in connection with the remedy being dismissal, mm-hmm. right? But not the argument that the district court erred by failing to balance speech and debate against something else.
Your Honor, my point was more, it was clear he was making that he thought his rights entitled him to this testimony. The government had their speech or debate argument, and that implicit in those two assertion of those two rights of balancing had to occur.
But isn't this is in connection with asking for dismissal of the case, not that he had a right that would overcome the speech or debate clause, but that given that the speech and debate clause wins, the case must be dismissed. Is that right? Am I interpreting it correctly?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Could you?
Yes. So one argument is that the district court erred
correct.
By excluding the testimony in the first place
mm-hmm.
because the speech and debate clause requires a balancing
right.
of the interests of the speech and debate clause against others. That argument I don't see being raised below. I see you raising it now, but I don't see it being raised below. Am I right about that?
Correct, Your Honor. If you do not read pages 365 to 370 as raising that is where I would point to in the record. Briefly, Defense Exhibit 149, it's a falsity issue. This does not have to do with whether or not it was on Schedule 7. The government introduced no evidence about the gift travel distinction. These instructions were the very instructions given to the defendant to tell him what to put on 6 and what to put on 7. To deny, relevance, I think these were clearly relevant, and given the lack of evidence on this point, I don't think the government can meet their harmless error standard. We're not saying the World Series ticket was travel, the World Series jersey was travel. It was the airfare, the hotel, and the transportation, those were travel. There was no evidence you could not commingle business and personal.
Can I ask about this? Yeah. So this is not an argument that you raised before that your opponent had an opportunity to respond to in the oral argument.
Right, Your Honor. Right. Yes, my time expired before that, but I didn't want to let it slip.
Right, but as long as we're on it, I do have a question about it. So.
Okay.
So this is the argument that the instructions regarding travel payments should have been put in?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the instructions regarding the gifts say travel in connection with official duties is reported separately.
Correct.
You don't think this was in connection with official duties, do you?
There was evidence that this trip had a significant official element. Those are the government's witnesses. So I guess let me restart.
Didn't he concede to the FBI agent, admit maybe is the better word, that it had no official purpose?
Your Honor, but official purpose, I think that's assuming that is the test. As in Schedule 7 instructions, the test was a trip taken not merely for your personal benefit.
But the instructions are quite clear that what is meant by that is if you have other outside business or activities. It says for travel in connection with an individual's other outside business or other activities. He didn't travel because he was working on his family's trust fund or anything like that, did he?
Well, first, Your Honor, I think just because there was other evidence doesn't make this evidence irrelevant. So that goes to the harmless error analysis, but it doesn't undermine the relevance prong of it. And two, while I understand the government would have offered that interpretation of that language, we respectfully disagree with that interpretation and that it could be broader and would include a trip like this, notwithstanding any admissions made by Mr. Borruccio. So the question is, first, relevance. I think clearly relevant. I know I don't think Schedule 6 paints the full story, especially when our argument is that the jury, you have to balance 6 and 7. I don't think it's too much at all to say, the instructions were on the government's exhibit list up until this point. So at some point, they too thought they had some sort of relevance.
Well, the example that's provided in the instructions for 7 say, for example, travel paid for by corporations that you or your family own. Travel that is necessary in connection with your service as an officer or board member.
That's an example of that, yes, Your Honor.
If this is not official travel, how do you think it fits under 7?
I would not concede that it's not official travel. I think at trial, the phrase official fact-finding mission, we never defined, was bandied about by some of the government's witnesses, none of whom had worked in the House. And so the question is more of just in a general scope, did this go on Schedule 6 or Schedule 7? We wanted to give the jury a full picture of how those two schedules interact with each other. So it's just, we're talking relevance here.
Well, actually, we're long as you raise it, we're fucking harmless error. So in light of the FBI agent's statement that he told him that the trip was not an official trip, it served no official purpose, he knew he should have reported it. He said it was not a fact-finding trip. So what other category do you have? You told me that it might fit under 7 because it was in part a fact-finding trip. Your client admitted it was not a fact-finding trip.
Your Honor, I think argument on that point would have gone to the question that the FBI agent asked Mr. Verrucchio, was he framed the question of, is it okay to go on a World Series trip? Again, that meeting occurred after the FBI had meeting. I mean, there were other very questionable circumstances surrounding that interview would have balanced that point out. So that would have been one rebuttal to that. But just in general, the lack of evidence the government introduced, no other evidence on the gift travel distinction, again, other than statements taken on a Sunday night by an armed FBI agent when they had been meeting with Bruce Verrucchio for a year prior on different matters. They show up at his house. So I think all of that needs to be taken into consideration.
In cross-examination and/or closing argument, did you argue that the FBI agent misrepresented what was said?
I don't recall that specifically. There were, during cross-examination, questions about the circumstances surrounding the interview were made, Your Honor, yes. So
the argument that he never said he would have had to said it was an official trip, in fact, it wasn't an official trip, the statement that it was not a fact-finding trip, was it argued that the FBI agent was lying or misrepresenting or misremembering?
It was argued that he did not present him with the forms. It was argued that the FBI agent was not an expert in gift travel distinction. So I think those go to that point, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll take the matter under submission. We thank the counsel for being willing to stand up in front of a difficult audience of fiercely interested students. Thank you, and we'll take a moment for the parties to change places in the two cases.